Writing a story for the Grapevine is really just the same thing as sharing in a meeting. I mean, that's what the Grapevine is filled with, shares.
The article I wrote, it sort of wrote itself. They were asking for articles about the big book and how we felt about it or how it influenced. And I remember thinking, I can do that. I love to write, but that wrote itself. And I'm glad they titled it. I didn't know what to title it.
Thank you so much for sending that in. Mary sat down and started writing. It wasn't hard to do.
I heard it through the grapevine.
Welcome. It's the AA Grapevine Half Hour Variety Hour featuring the collected voices of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm Don, an alcoholic in Greensboro, North Carolina.
Hey, Don. Hey, everybody. I'm Sam, an alcoholic in Palm Springs, California.
Hiya, Sam.
What's up, Mr. Don? It's been a minute.
It's good to see you. I subscribe to the Grapevine Daily Quote email, and I get that every day in the mail, but there's a bunch of other services that do Quote of the Day as well. And another one that I get all the time is the Dow Recovery Quote of the Day. Dow is spelled T-A-O.
Thank you for that lesson.
If you wanted to search for it, that's where the expression, I doubt it, came from.
I don't believe you.
When you say, I doubt it, that means I let go of it. That's the way we use it.
I think you're making that up.
Well, anyway, I don't know if that's true or not.
I doubt that's true.
Just let go, Sam. There you go. You're letting go, even as we speak.
Just as hard as I
possibly can. So this had a quote from the Big Book. But it's from the fourth edition, and I've never seen it before because I just bought a fourth edition maybe 3 or 4 months ago, and I've never read the stories in the back, and they're different. There's some really good ones in there.
Don, did you know there's a fifth edition coming out soon?
Well, yes, and I'm looking forward to it. And
I think you're a little behind here, buddy.
I'm going to get it probably in about a decade.
I'm a fourth edition guy. I came in and the fourth edition was the first book that I got.
Well, my third edition has, it's underlined and underscored and it has different colors on everything. It's got notes in the margin. It's got drawings. It's got important things that people said in meetings that changed my life. And
lots and lots of doodling because you are an artist and your mind just requires you to do that, right?
There is a little bit of doodling in there. And I try to doodle elsewhere than in my big book.
Well, Don, that was incredibly fascinating. But we've got an email from a listener.
Wait a minute. I detected a note of sarcasm in there.
You act like you know me. This email is from David S. in Chicago.
Thanks for writing, David.
The subject is gratitude. David goes on to write, I just wanted to send you all a quick note to say that I've been enjoying the podcast a lot. I listen to it often while going for my lunchtime walk along the shore of Lake Michigan. I thought I would forward you a photo of my view from my walk today. Keep up the great work.
Yeah, so David sent us a photo that's just a beautiful picture of Lake Michigan and the Chicago skylines across the water in the distance there. And I've never been to Chicago.
Oh.
Have you?
Yeah, I have. A handful of times.
It looks like the ocean. That lake is big.
It is kind of big. It's not a puddle.
It looked deep. Is it a port? Ooh. Is Chicago a port city?
Google is your friend.
Okay. Well, it was great and a beautiful picture of the skyline in the background. If you want to see what we're talking about, look at the Grapevine account on Instagram. All right, Sam, what's on the podcast today?
Don, today we're returning to our recurring segment,
Blast from the Past.
It's a recording of Dewey S., one of the first 100 members of Alcoholics Anonymous, recorded in 1969. And Dr. Bob gives him some advice. Don't start with your algebra until you first finish your arithmetic.
This blast from the past sounds explosive.
Well, that's what happens when time collapses and the past collides with the present.
Is this the fourth dimension of existence that I've heard so much about?
Wibbly wobbly timey wimey stuff.
Oh, yeah.
But before that, we'll rocket into the fourth dimension with Mary R. from Snellville, Georgia. Mary has an article in the upcoming April issue.
Yep. Her article is just what we need. The title is Healing Words, and it'll be on page 20 or available in the app.
Grapevine is looking for CPC stories.
What is CPC?
Cooperation with the professional community.
If you have provided doctors, therapists, clergy, lawyers, teachers, parole officers, and other professionals information about AA, then you have done CPC work.
And we want your stories about how you got into that kind of service, what it's like, what you've learned, and how it's enhanced your sobriety.
Alternatively, did a professional help you find your way to AA? That's the other side of CPC work. Or are you a professional who found out about AA from members doing CPC work?
Stories can be from 300 words to 1,800 words in length. Please send your stories to aagrapevine.org/share.
Stories are due by April 1st, 2024.
Hey, my name is Mary and I'm alcoholic. Glad to be here. My sobriety date is July 21st, 1988, and I live in Snellville, Georgia, just outside Atlanta. And I'm a member of the Blue Chips group in Loganville, Georgia.
The Blue Chips group. Blue Chips. That sounds fantastic. How'd that? What do Blue Chips mean in Snellville, Georgia?
Well, I think the guy who started the group was thinking along the line of like, you know, blue chip stock, like really, really good stuff, I think. Something. And then, of course, there's the thing about the anniversary chip. We have the blue chip.
What does that denote? Because here in Greensboro, North Carolina, blue chip is 30 days.
Okay. Yeah. It's for a year, multiples of years. That's our year chip.
Yeah, I think that's also the case in the Raleigh area of North Carolina.
What about in Palm Springs?
It's typically the metallic chip.
Yeah.
Mary, 1988. That's been a minute. What was going on that made you consider walking into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous?
You know, I had tried for 2 years to quit drinking on my own. I was a newlywed. I think my husband, before we got married, kind of had his own idea that somehow marriage would fix me, maybe. I maybe had that same fantasy, and I just couldn't stop. And my sister at the time was, you know, she was getting some treatment for depression, and I thought, well, I'm depressed too, you know? So I called a psychiatrist. I remember they said, well, is this an emergency? Do you need to come in right away? And I was like, well, of course not. I mean, you know, I'm really fine. So 2 weeks later, I went in to see this lady. And in the meantime, I had a chance to kind of get honest. And I quit trying to hide my drinking from my husband and pretty much told him to F off, you know, which I don't talk to him like that anymore. Mm-hmm. And I decided that I was going to tell the doctor everything, you know, no secrets. So I did. And I went in and she said, yeah, I you may be depressed, but we can't tell till you've been sober at least 6 months. And so
that's a tall order.
In a way, I wasn't surprised. And in a way, I was. But I was more just like shocked. So, but, you know, and I ended up going to a meeting that night. My husband drove me. So I was a high bottom, theoretically, but okay. I tell you, my soul was in shreds and emotionally too. So,
yeah, that was my story as well. Had you heard of Alcoholics Anonymous?
I'm a nurse. And so we had learned that in nursing school. And back in 88, it was pretty blunt. They pretty much said, well, alcoholics, you know, they went into all the physical stuff and they said the solution is Alcoholics Anonymous, not a lot of information. And abuse. Mm. And also we had a psychiatric rotation and my roommate was at the alcohol treatment. I was just at the regular psych part. And she said, you need to come with me. They were required to go to a couple of meetings.
Uh-huh.
And she dragged me along and it was really vivid. But I was sort of a visitor. I didn't think I was that bad, the old story. So,
And real quick, you mentioned ant abuse, and for folks who don't know, I just want to mention that's a drug that you can take that if you drink alcohol while you're taking it, you get violently ill. So it's a tool to help someone not drink.
So what do you think? Describe the hardest thing when you came to AA that first time.
It's funny because I think in my gut, well, for one thing, drinking had stopped working. In a way, I'm lucky if it had still been helping, but I felt like hell. Can I say hell?
Oh, yes.
I felt like hell all the time, drunk or sober. So I had very little to lose, but I did miss my medicine, I think. And I am dual addicted, I'll just mention. So I had kind of a long withdrawal.
From the depression medicine, you're
Well, no, this was more from stuff that street stuff.
street medicine.
Yes, street medicine. Yeah, what do they call that? Side dishes, you know? My first 3 to 6 months, I'd say I was just numb and my mind was racing. And I went every day. To my surprise, the meetings helped. And that was part of the deal with the doctor. She wanted to put me in treatment. I did not want to go, but we'd agreed that I'd go to a meeting every day. And like I say, they started helping in a, like I 51%, I might feel like I needed to drink 49%, but 51% I got from the meeting. I hear
Gotcha.
something.
I also walked into AA. I didn't go to treatment, and I got sober in the rooms by discovering that every time I went to a meeting, I felt a little bit better. Can you describe the first time that it hit you that you had to drink? You really needed to get a drink. Maybe you even started getting the shakes. What you did,
Oh,
how do you
wow.
got through that?
I had about 60 days, I think, and I went to a meeting. It was a speaker meeting, and the woman described relapsing at 60 days. And I thought, aha, that's a sign from God. And I know driving home, I felt like the car was almost pulling itself over every time I passed a gas station where I could buy beer or something. And I went in, and I was standing in my apartment. I still had my coat on. And I thought, I'll just turn around and, I'd fought it all the way home. But then the phone rang and it was my husband. And I just blurted out to him that I really felt like I was just going to go ahead and drink. And at the time, I had a temporary sponsor, et cetera, but it didn't really sink into me to call that person. But somehow, saying it to my husband helped. And he suggested something like maybe I could eat a decent meal. What a concept. So, and I did, and it felt better. And the next day, I went to a meeting, and a friend of mine, we would sit together and kind of support each other. He said, man, I just came from pacing in front of the liquor store. I really wanted to buy a drink, buy a bottle. And I said, well, why don't you bring it up? And he said, oh, I can't do that. So at the start of the meeting, when they asked if anyone had a topic, I blurted out. And I got so much loving, realistic, calm, blunt feedback. I remember going out to my car after the meeting and I grabbed a little notebook I had in my purse and scribbled down some of the suggestions like call first, say a prayer, et cetera. And I still carry that in my wallet to this day. So,
Oh, wow.
folks, we asked Mary if she could send us a photo of that list. She found it. She did. And if you'd like to take a look, go to Instagram and search for the Grapevine feed. We'll post it there and you can take a look.
oh, and can I add too, at the end of that meeting, a woman came up to me who'd always been real friendly. She handed me her phone number and said, why don't you plan on calling me every day for a while? She became my sponsor.
Fabulous, fabulous. I love that you brought up what was going on when they asked about anybody need to share or anybody got a topic. That's the time to do, especially in early recovery, but frankly, at any point in our
Any point.
recovery.
Anytime I'm squirrely, it's the time to bring it up. And that means even like in emotional turmoil, I need to bring it up and share what's going on with me. Because just as you said, Mary, the very act of sharing it somehow releases the pressure that is on me.
I'm a big believer in that. Yeah, honesty.
Yeah. And sharing it in a meeting, it's surprising how much that helps other people.
Did you ever have something catastrophic or something really rough happen to you that you shared in a meeting to get through it rather than drink?
Wow. To me, a lot of it is that the day-to-day life can be kind of catastrophic. Just, you
yeah.
know,
yeah.
I'm one of those people who, you know, pole vaults over, you know, mouse poop or whatever.
Yes.
I can remember I got a promotion at work and I ended up doing my old job along with my new job. And it was really, really hard. And I was real insecure, too. And I remember going to meetings so exhausted. And practically all I could get out was just that I'm just exhausted. I think I've done a crazy thing at my job. And that was the best I could do. But it did keep me sober.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I love that you talk about the day-to-day stuff because the broken shoestring that we get drunk over.
Yeah.
It's not the big things that have happened in my life that were going to send me out to a drink. It's the daily annoyances.
Yeah, I know. And it's kind of embarrassing sometimes, but, you know, people will say, I can suffer from an ingrown toenail, you know, or something like that. And I got to share about it, even though, you know, someone, like you say, people have catastrophes too. I still can suffer from that kind of thing. So it helps, you know.
So you've been sober a long time. You still go to meetings?
Yeah, I probably go at least 4 times a week. I've always been one of those people who needs meetings. There were times when I sort of thought, gee, you know, I wish I could kind of cut back because I'd keep my house in better shape or, you know, I would take care of more chores. But I've never been able to do that. I need every meeting in a way. And then I always had a sponsor. I have one pretty committed, wonderful sponsee, you know, that's been stuck with me for, you know, 4 or 5 years now. It's a privilege. And then, you know, usually I'll have 3 or 4 people maybe are supposed to be calling or whatever, you know.
Yeah.
You know.
Mary, tell me, how does your sponsee help you?
Well, you know, we love each other. And she makes me, I guess, kind of remember. She's at that phase in her life where she's got toddlers and infants, and it's hard for her to make meetings. And, you know, and sometimes she really feels like she's going out of her mind. And I can kind of remember those days and tell her it will pass. Before you know it, they're going to be in school. And she's got a strong program. I'm so blessed. She is committed to staying sober. And man, that is a real gift to be able to sponsor someone with that commitment.
It is indeed. And one of the favorite things that has happened is a sponsee quoting back to me something I told them 6 or 8 months ago, and I needed it today.
Oh, yeah. That stings a little bit, depending on how they say it. I mean, I had a sponsee. I was talking about something really rough going on in my life, and he looked at me with a raised eyebrow. Well, Don, I heard there's always a little more letting go to do. And I've told him that so many times.
Yeah.
Mary, is there anything that you heard that's just like a little nugget?
I remember my sponsor saying many times, the best we can hope for is basic human being. You know, when I start to wander and think I need to get perfect or be better than I am, you know, and even though I've got some time sober, I'm a basic human being and I've got to, you know, drop the ego and share when I'm struggling, that kind of thing. I'll never be a saint.
In my home group, there's a guy who's passed on now. He used to talk about being right-sized all the time and don't draw attention to yourself. You're just a garden variety drunk. And every time that anyone would speak, he'd go up to him. And it was the highest compliment if he came up to you and said, after you finished speaking, adequate.
Oh, I love it. All right. Yeah.
You did an adequate job. Thank you. I got adequate from my friend.
Yeah. There's a treatment center meeting we do. It's kind of a drive, so I try to go as often as I can because a lot of times it's just the basics. Being with those guys and realizing how much things have changed. Mm-hmm. You know, in the big book where the acceptance is the answer.
Mm-hmm. Is that in the fourth edition as well?
Why, yes, it is.
Oh, good.
Right around in there somewhere, he says, being an alcoholic, I never would have thought that that would be good. And he said something like, this just proves I don't know what's good for me. And a lot of times, I'm very resistant to anything that's painful or hard. A lot of times it's got those fingernail, I'm pretty stubborn with that stuff, but it encourages me to know I don't know what's good for me. This might be good for me doing this podcast. I've been very kind of, nervous or whatever, but my sponsor, it might be good for you,
That's
know.
when your sponsor says that,
Yeah,
you're in
yeah.
trouble.
Yeah.
Is there something that you would tell someone who is thinking about going to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous?
The psychiatrist who sent me to AA, I think she saved my life. She told me, don't try to figure it out all at once. And for my personality, that was the perfect thing to hear because it's a lifetime. It's not like going to cramming in a class for college and just studying the stuff in the back and spitting it out. It's learning to live, and I wanted it to be fast, but anything is better than the way I was. Another thing for me, I'm one of those people, bring the body and the mind will follow. I'm not proud of this or anything. I thought I was pretty smart because I was, a darn nurse. I had passed nursing school, but I looked at the steps on the wall and thought, well, I don't understand what that means, searching and fearless and moral inventory. I mean, and I remember thinking, there's something wrong with you, Mary. You've got a ways to go. If this might take a while to sink in. God's been generous to me. I haven't had to have a drink. I used to need to drink. I used to have to drink. And that's one thing I almost want to tell people. There will come a time when, like it says in the big book, where you recoil almost at the thought of it.
How does that happen?
Boy, I think it is a higher power. It is God. Because like I say, I tried for 2 years with everything I had to not drink, and maybe I could go a couple months at the most. And I tell this story when we, talk about the second step.
Step two came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity.
Yeah, about 18 months in, I realized that I hadn't had a drink and there was no way I could have stayed sober that long on my own. And at that point, I was kind of blown away because, like I say, I resisted everything. I didn't have a great attitude. The God that I think I kind of grew up listening, I thought he would have struck me drunk by then, but he hadn't. I just started to realize that maybe he was merciful. And I had some hope. I got some hope. That's when I think my higher power really started to become real to me,
You've been sober, Mary, for 35 years, and you go to four meetings a week. My comfort zone is three meetings a week plus a day, really, of meeting with sponsees. And then I find that I can deal with the stresses of life. But what would you say to someone who goes, oh my God, 30 years going to meetings?
I think I would say I was a bad drunk. I need the meetings. Everybody's story is a little bit different. The thing about meetings, like you said, I've had periods where I couldn't make as many meetings as I would have liked to. And I'd find I'd get in the meetings and I'd get what I needed to feel better. And it was wonderful. But if I go to enough meetings, then I find myself listening more to your stuff and what you need. And that's even better, But someone who's new, give it a try and see, And I was a bad drunk, and I thought for a long time in AA, I was going to sit on my hands and grit my teeth and miss drinking. But I don't sit on my hands. I don't grit my teeth. I don't miss it like the way I thought I would. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. And I love that thing about how long do I have to go to meetings until you want to go?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mary, thank you so much for joining us today. It's been absolutely a pleasure chatting with you and get to know
Thank
you a little
you,
bit.
Mary.
Thank you. You guys were real nice. I was very nervous, but you made me feel real relaxed. Thank you.
Thank you.
She just blew out a puff of air.
Your shoulders just dropped, Mary.
Blast from the past.
And now Dewey S. talks about getting sober in the early 1940s. He was one of the first 100 members of Alcoholics Anonymous. This excerpt was originally recorded January 17, 1969. It's about 8 minutes long. If you want to hear his whole talk, go to recoveryspeakers.com and search Dewey S.
So I came into AA on this basis. I figured it out. I had nothing to lose and everything to gain. I was sure these fellows couldn't make a worse mess out of my life than I made out of myself. So I would go into AA for 30 days, and I would do whatever they told me to do, and mechanically if I had to. If I had to walk around at night at midnight smoking a cigar, wearing a Katie hat, I'd do that too. So that was the basis that I came into AA, virtually dared them to sober me up. I went to my first meeting on my own, and I sat on my hands to keep from falling off the chair. And when the meeting was over, Dr. Boggs came over. He said, well, what do you think of it? I said, Doc, I feel like a kid going to school again. He said, that's about what it amounts to. He said, this is an AA is an educational institution. He said, there's no provisions made for the teacher to resign, no provisions made for the pupil to graduate. He said, we're both the pupils and the teacher. And he told me that night that it was just as important for me to pray as it was to preach, and just as important to learn as it was to teach. And he quoted me a little verse from Pope's essay. He said, a little learning is a dangerous thing. Drink deep or taste not of this Pyrenean spring, where shallow dust intoxicate the brain, and drinking deeply sobers us again. Now, I said, I want you to get on and stay with the fellows that know something about this program. Stay with the fellows that are working at it, and learn all you can. Well, that wasn't as easy as it sounded, because at that particular time, Bill and Doc were the only ones that really knew what the score was. There were a hell of a lot of us, and they, at that time, didn't even know it was a game on. So I started going back to the meetings, and there was a terrible experience. I was nervous, I was excitable, I heard a lot of things I didn't agree with, things I didn't want to hear. I still hear things, a lot of things in the AA that I don't want to hear, that I don't agree with. But I've learned since that I can put aside that which I don't want for temporary, and keep it for further reference. Doc left me that night, he gave me one parting shot. He said, now look, one thing you'll remember, don't start with your algebra till you finish taking your arithmetic. And I interpreted that to mean I should put first things first. So I started out on that basis, doing everything people told me to do. I was in such a position, I had no choice. I had to accept. Come on. And I heard things, one of the things that annoyed me a great deal was that everybody in the place started to tell me that I must work the program. But nobody told me how. The first meeting I went to, one fellow got up and told me how much liquor he drank before he came into AA. Another meeting, a man told me what a good job he had gotten through AA. Another one told me how many jails he'd been in and so forth. And about the fourth night, I got up and I said, look, I said, if you're going to tell stories, let me in on it. I can tell you some pretty good ones myself, but I want to know how to work the program. Well, I didn't know at the time, but I was a member of the stuffed shirt group, and the beginners were not supposed to talk for the first 3 or 4 months, 6 months, I believe it was. So I guess they decided they would put the quietus on me and put me in my place. Because the next Sunday morning, at 6 o'clock in the morning, I got a telephone call. It was zero weather, blizzard going on outside. And some fellow had some hillbilly who had been drinking since he was 13 years old, wanted to suddenly decide to quit drinking, written New York, and the call returned back, and I got the call. And incidentally, that was only one of the first. Whenever they had a man who was too tough that nobody wanted to bother with, I got the call. They were going to quiet me down. Well, I started out looking for this fellow that morning, and I hunted for him. And finally, I found him and his wife, a little boy, in one of the most terrible, poverty-stricken places you ever saw in your life. There were three of them living in one room. And over on the windowsill, there was a half a loaf of bread and a half a bottle of milk. That had been their menu for days. She had the whips packed and was ready to leave. I finally got her quieted down. She agreed to give me another chance. Then I went over and talked to the little boy. He was crying in the corner. Every time he opened his mouth, he had it slapped shut. I got him quieted down. And then I went over to talk to the man. He was sitting on the edge of the bed, shaking his eye. I'd never seen a man shake before. At first, I thought he had St. Vitus dance. And he shook and shook and shook. It was my first call, and I was nervous and embarrassed. And I didn't know what I said to him. And I'm damn sure he didn't know what I said to him either. But when I got up to go, he followed me out the door, and he said, can you come back tomorrow? Yes, I will be back tomorrow. I'm going to get this cookie. I went back the next day, and the next day, and the next day, and the next day. And finally, this fellow quit shaking and went back to work. About 2 weeks after that, I went down to their house one night, and she met me at the door. She was all flushed with excitement. Look, look, he gave it all to me. She showed me the first industrial paycheck she'd ever seen. He'd always found time to cash it on the way home. She never knew how much money he made. And he told me, it's all mine. I'll run a suit myself. She was beginning to get something out of AA. In the next 3 months, the whole marvelous miracle of AA unfolded right before my very eyes. About 2 weeks later, 2 or 3 weeks later, I went down and the little boy came out. He laid down a little pair of shoes, a romper suit, and a top coat. He looked up at me and he said, Mr. Reese, my dad got these for me. He said, I ain't scared of them anymore. And then, for the first time in my life, I began to realize how many people other than ourselves we hurt when we drink to excess. I had a little boy and a little girl. No doubt I had hurt them just as the same. And it still hurts to talk about it. But the little boy was getting something out of this now. 3 months passed. He called me. He said, we moved. I went down. I stood on the porch that night before I rang the bell. It wasn't a palace. It wasn't a mansion. It was a nice little cottage. And there were drapes and curtains at the window. And rugs on the floor. And where I was standing, I could look straight back in the kitchen. And I saw a great, nice, shiny refrigerator with honest-to-God food in it. And these people thought a modern miracle happened. This fellow hadn't had a drink for 3 months. He was up there in front with his boy, sitting at the table, helping him with his lessons. And she was sewing or listening to the radio. And they couldn't believe it. And I never saw happiness shining out of people's eyes like shining out of their eyes that night. And that night, I became an AA in fact. Up to that time, I was only registered. Because my age, I was still doubting whether it would be worthwhile for me to try to stay sober the rest of my life. I led a pretty rotten sort of a life. And I felt that people always remember that. They'd always look at me as that no-good so-and-so. But that night, there seemed to be a little patch of blue in the sky. Because it occurred to me that perhaps now, if I could forget my own troubles and try to bring a little happiness to the lives of other people, maybe I could become people too. And it worked out very nicely for me. Not long after that, the Saturday Evening Post articles came out. And people began to flood into Cleveland from all parts of the country. In fact, Cleveland became the hub of AA activity because it was a little closer to the rest of the country than New York and a little more accessible than Akron. And people from all parts of the country came in there. At night, we'd go home from work. There would be 10 men at the Statler Hotel, some more, 8 more at the other hotels. And they pressed us into service regardless of how much experience you had. It wasn't a question whether you wanted to work, you had to work. I've never given advice. The only advice I ever gave was don't take any advice from me, you might get drunk. But coming into this thing, I can tell you this, that your best defense against that first drink is activity in AA. Being active somewhere, helping put the chairs up, helping clean out the ashtrays. There's no menial tasks in AA. They're all worthwhile. Just as worthwhile as a fellow stands up and pops off for half an hour. And some say that you can go to meetings and sit there and it'll wear off on you. But I'm here to tell you that if you start taking it internally, it'll work a lot more faster. So that's what I would do. If I were coming in today, a new man night, I would go up to the secretary and I would just pester the hell out of him until he gave me some kind of a job, regardless of what it was. And I think he would thank you for it afterwards.
In 1938, a group of the first alcoholics are anxiously waiting in the living room. Dr. Bob comes down the stairs and says,
"Boys, I've got some good news and I've got some bad news. Good news is I got him down to 12. The bad news is direct amends are still in."
It's really not that funny.
Thanks for joining us. The AA Grapevine Half Hour Variety Hour is posted every Monday and is produced by AA Grapevine, Inc. We don't speak for AA as a whole. We share the experience, strength, and hope of members to help others recover from alcoholism. Podcast info, including how to call in, is at aagrapevine.org/podcast. Search AA Grapevine in the App Store on your phone or find AA Grapevine on Instagram and YouTube. All things Grapevine are available at aagrapevine.org. If you want to know more about AA, search online for Alcoholics Anonymous in your city or visit aa.org.
That was freaking amazing.